So you wanna know? Welcome to the Swana Know podcast. I'm your host, Annelisa Swana. Join us every week as we explore stories of triumph, resilience, and anything you wanna know. So today we have Shedrick Nsua with us, who is an upcoming MMA champion. We speak things into being here.
Yes.
So he is an upcoming champion. Shedrick will share with us his story of resilience and the many sacrifices he's had to make to get to where he is. Welcome, Shedrick.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm not alone today. It's so funny.
Yeah.
I'm not with Kelly Kells. I'm with another guy with a beard.
Yes, unfortunately, you're stuck with me today. I'm sorry.
Today, I'm joined by Rian Marais, one of the Herald's reporters. Hi, Rian.
Hi, Annelisa. How are you?
I'm good. Welcome to the Swana Know podcast.
Good. Yeah, it's lucky to be here. Thanks for having me.
Sure. So, Shedrick, I just want to know a bit about you. And I'm sure our listeners would love to know a bit about you as well. Who's Shedrick?
It's a whole journey. For me, I'm a refugee in a country, and moved in a country as a minor, very young, and I didn't know the reason why I moved in a country, because I was just asked to wake up one morning, very dark in the morning, pick bags, you know, here you are. You'll be safe in this place, to stay there for a while, and from there move to that. So it's like every time I just moved I kind of had to grow up as a young kid, first of all. Why? Because I had a younger sister with me,
sure.
And I kind of had to look after her. So the one morning my mom just woke me up, I think it was around three, four in the morning, and she told me, I'll never forget the words, she's like, you're a man now. You're a man, so you gotta look after your sister. So there's the bags and everything. You guys are going somewhere that's a bit more safer, but look at it as a trip. So it's like a trip you guys are going to, just, you know, enjoy it and have fun. We'll see you very soon and stuff. So we didn't know much. Here we are, me and my little sister.
And sorry, Shedrick, how old are you at that time?
I would say about 6, 7-ish, just before turning 10 years old at the time, yeah. There I was with my younger sister in a bus. First, we went, obviously, to a place called Lubumbashi. It's still in the DRC. Spent a few months there with supposedly my mom's close friend, and she kicked us out for personal reasons as well. Then we had to leave from there to Zambia, from Zambia to, I think it was Zimbabwe. And from there, obviously, we had to trust somebody else to come with us as well, because the person who was an adult and told us, spoke to my mom to look after us until we can get to the safer place, which we knew it was a trip we're taking, still young. And there we are all the way. To SA, obviously, we get there early morning. He drops us at the park and he's like, no, you guys just wait, yeah? Call your mom, tell your mom that I've obviously dropped you guys where you should be. And a few hours later, we waited. There comes a man. He came to pick us up at the park, told me it was my father's friend, and he spoke to my mom. And then he picked us up at the park. We stayed with him for about a year and a half. Ishmael was more of my father's close friend, and they became more like family. So we looked at him as an uncle in our family, at least. Yeah, but it was just another chapter of your life, in a way. And then I thought, we're safe now. And he couldn't look after us as much, because obviously financial reasons for himself as well. So sent us down to PE. In Motherwell, and he had a girlfriend. She had a bit of a drug problem. Any money she would get, she obviously wanted to satisfy herself with, you know, her drug issues and stuff. So, and my uncle, who was Ishmael at the time, worked at a security company. So it's like a 6 in the morning, like 6 in the evening. So like for like the entire 18 hours, she's at work, comes home, tired. He just wants to sleep. He doesn't really want to hear much, because he knows the next morning he needs to wake up early and another shift. So Yeah, and also problem, whatever happened throughout the day, if you tell him during the night, it's fine, he's going to listen to you, but the next day he's still going to go through worse. So might as well just keep it for yourself. Kids would go to school, me and my sister wouldn't, so it was a bit weird, because we would stay at home, do the chores, go to cooking, clean up and everything. The kids at school come back, they have to make sure that everything is sorted when everybody comes at home. So it was more of us just working, in a way, and abuse just kept getting worse at the time. And every time, you know, it was just piling up more and more. I remember the one time, I think one of our daughter hit my sister with a hammer in the head, and she did absolutely nothing about it. She's like, no, just brush it off, just let it go. She got upset with me the one time. She was cooking and asked for me to get something under the shelf. And I never understood how the whole pan of oil fell on my head. Never made sense to me, but I accepted it. I was like, it's fine, it's my mistake. The one time, my uncle left us some cash, obviously 200 rand at the time, and she wanted that money. We had tussled with the money because I kind of held it in my hand. She bit me, still got a scar on my hand until today, bleeding all over my hand. The abuse kind of piled up in a way that I felt it was a bit too much, and I was like, nah, I can't take this anymore. I just need a bit of peace. I just need a bit of time away from this. It was not something that I consciously made a decision that I really want to run away right now. It just happened that I decided now I'm done. Because on top of that, nobody took initiative of taking me to the hospital or bothering to worry why I was cut. So I was like, I just left. I had a sister, so I couldn't just disappear. I had to make sure that I kept an eye on her and just looked after her however I could, just to make sure that she was safe. She's sleeping in her house, nice and warm, you know. So there was a car two streets away, an abandoned car. So I'll just sleep there, wake up 5 o'clock in the morning before the owner of the car would find me and go about my stuff.
That is so brave.
Yeah, I had birds waking me up. So.
That is so brave.
That was the best way I could have. Whenever you could hear the birds, I knew, like, it's fine.
It's wake up time.
It's time to wake up now. No matter how cold it was or how much I wanted to sleep, I'm like, just wake up before you get fined. Yeah.
Sure.
Breakfast would be very difficult because I would wait up until like 10, 11-ish and I'd go to ShopRite and where they normally slice the bread. It was like I'd been on the bottom. I know a lot of people know. They pull the bin and it's like crumbs of all the breads that was like left over, just put them in a plastic and that's like buy a drink or pop and get some water. That's your breakfast for the day. You know.
How old? You're seven?
No, at the time I was about 11, 12,
okay.
I'd say. It's a bit of time already there. And I just had it. I was like, that was my life now. For about, I think it was about a month and a half. I was just living that life. And I ran into one of our neighbors. Don't even know if she recognized me and she knew me. She stopped me. She's like, why do you look so bizarre? Why do you look so dirty? And I just broke down and started telling her what was happening. Very, very, very lovely woman. She took me to her house. She opened up a fridge, offered me food. And funny, I'm like, how is this possible? Ever since I moved to ASA, never experienced that type of appreciation to that type of people. You know, it was really awkward in the time. I was like, how is this even possible? So she gave me clothes and, after changing, and she was like, do you want to call your mom? I didn't know about the area codes at the time, so I just gave her my mom's number. Then she's like, no, there must be a code. Where are you from? She took initiative in finding out where my mom was from and the code and everything. And then she managed to get hold of my mom. And then she told me, take your time. Tell her everything. And at the time, you had to pay for every call you made. It's like 2 rand a minute. She told me, take your time. I was like, wow, okay, sure. I explained everything to my mom. She told me don't hide anything, tell everything. So I told my mom everything. And my mom broke down on the phone and she cried. After I hung up the phone, she told me, go home, go to your sister. no matter what's the problem is, if you guys want to leave the house, come to me. So I told her, okay, no problem. So she took me home, and she asked them, how long have I been missing? They told her, how long have I been missing? She asked them if you guys called the police. She said, they said no. And I asked them, you guys told the parents? They said no. She's like, what, how? And they never really even answered that. And like, she went home. I think about a month later, my father came, and my father stayed there as well for about a month. He experienced a bit of what we were going through. And then he's like, no, we got to move out of here. So sure. We got our own place together, the three of us. That's kind of like the first time I kind of started experiencing a bit more peace. I don't have to wake up early to cook or clean, sure, do anything.
My father, you can be a child again.
Like, that was the first time ever. And then like, the following year, we went to school. It was a bit weird because ever since I've been in S, I never went to school. It was like the first time going to school. And he still had to adapt in a learning curriculum. So it was it was very difficult for me. But I've found space in a bit of sport in there because I tried playing soccer, rugby, a bit of this and that. It was a bit peaceful. It was quite nice. I enjoyed it. Until I was in high school. In high school, I went to Peterson High School. I wasn't interested in sport at the time. I was like, I just want to go to school, just go home, just go to school and go home. And there was a guy called Fornling, Sean Fornling. He forced me to get into rugby. Sure.
Because you were a big boy. I mean, you were a big boy. He was like, we need some size in this team.
He really wanted me to get into rugby. He tried his best. And I started ducking him at the time. Sometime I'll see him and I'll just duck him in school. He came to my class the one time. He didn't really want to push me. And he just told me one thing. He said, like, think about it. You can be good in academy work. You can be academically smart, but sport can take you places that you never thought you'd be. You can start playing rugby and you'll do some different sport after. So try it and you'll see what happens. And I gave it a try. I enjoyed rugby. I really did. I thought rugby would have been like the profession. I really enjoyed it. I really loved it. Still do. Because obviously it taught me something that I never relied on anybody in my life. There was nobody I could rely on ever in my life. Even though my dad was here, it was a bit difficult to just rely on anybody because that's what I knew growing up. I was like, rely on no one, just do everything yourself.
So now in rugby,
I've got a guy next to me that I have to kind of understand that, no, in case of whatever happens, I trust him to back me. So, it that taught me a lot more. And not just relying to people and start opening up more into teamwork and team building. And I kind of started enjoying that me because it was a very different type of a person. I was more of a closed person. I was antisocial in school. During the break, I'll sit in a class and just mind my business. Mm. And in grade 11, they made me a captain in a team. For me, I never really appreciate stuff. Something would happen, I'd be like, move on. I said, just move on. Everybody's like, why does it seem so?
It's just another thing.
What can I do? Just move on. And after I don't know how long we played one of the tournaments, and I managed to pull it through that I actually won it. It was a privilege for the school, and for me it was also just like,
you're just fighting, like you've always been fighting.
And everybody just kind of kept looking at me as like weird, because like, dude, it's this big achievement, how are you looking at it like that? I'm like, this is a normal one. Now we'll move on. After school, varsity, NMU, I played in NMU. I think first season I played about second team or something, and then the previous season I was playing first reserve and I was benching for the first team, and everybody was telling me it's just like a privilege. I was like, guys, this is the normal thing, it's just the game, I'm trying to enjoy myself. And I did not understand appreciating everything that comes with my hard work was also very important at the time.
Do you think that comes down to you're so used to things going badly or things being taken away that was sort of what you were doing? Like, I get these nice things, but I'm expecting it not to last. So you think that's sort of where it comes from?
I'd say so, because for me, I'd say, like you said it, for me, I never experienced like that. I've always chased that feelings that put you in a... It's like the adrenaline, everything else together. It's a crazy feel. Like, I don't know if you watched the UFC 308. I mean,
yes.
For Topuria to knock out, I mean, it's a big fight. And this guy, everybody doubted him in the world. And let's just make a big example, Jigas, for example, that feeling. The first ever time he lifted a title, that's always feeling that chase. I don't want anything. I just want that feeling.
Yes.
That's all I want. And that's all I've been chasing for my whole life. And whatever I do, whatever that I do in my life, I want to know what it feels like to do it so perfect without any fault. And knowing the fact that you've done everything around, ticking every boxes, knowing now I did all this, I want to know how that feels like. That's what I've always... I think that's why I feel everything I do, or that's why I felt everything I've done. It's like, yeah, it's good, but I just want more. I just really want more. Yeah.
Take me, Shadrack. So you touched on your early rugby career, now playing NMU. But then there was another setback. I remember we talked about this 2 years ago. You came down with osteochondroma. Just run us through. What exactly was that again?
Osteochondroma is... it's basically like an overgrown bone that grows in any part of your body. Mine just unfortunately was growing on my femur. And it kind of cracks through the bone marrow and growing up. And the fluid hardens up, start to kind of basically becomes a bone. And the more you leave it, it grows more like a tumor. And then it becomes more like cancer in a spot that they have to... If they find it early, they remove it. If they don't, then you kind of have to amputate that part. So for me... Medical reasons, obviously, I didn't have medical aid, still don't have medical aid, trying to get that sort of stuff, because it's a very important spot that we're doing. And every time I go to the hospital, they tell me, nah, you're good, man, it's fine. And so it started giving a lot of issues with my knee. It affected my ACL and my knee. So I just practically stopped rugby because the knee was so vulnerable. Every game I'd play, the knee had a problem, and... It became so bad that my knee would just pop, and it would stay like that for about a month or so. I just kind of had to deal with the pain, deal with everything at the time. And one day I went for a checkup in a hospital, just normal. The doctor Thomas just looked at my leg and was like, this thing is growing. The last time he saw me, this thing wasn't this big. And then he asked me to do a CT. We did a CT, came back and said, you're not going home. You're going to have to cut that thing off your leg. Oh, we're going to have to cut the leg off. So, it didn't sink into me. I was like, oh, damn. Okay, so I called my parents. Called my father. I was like, nah, this is what's happening. I'm going to have to stay in the hospital. They're going to have to do a surgery. A day later, they did a surgery on it. It was quite successful. It was like quite a big part they cut off there. And 2 years I had to stay off sports, and because they cut it off the femur, they told me I have to take 2 years off, and after 2 years I'm there, not sure if I'm going to actually play, because the femur will be vulnerable and kind of soft because they cut a part of it. Yeah.
Even the 2 year break is a lot.
It's a lot, yeah.
For someone who's always active, who prides themselves with playing sports.
You had this path, I'm going to become a professional athlete, and now you've got a career-ending injury before your career even actually started.
And you have to wait it out for 2 years before you know, is it going to work out, is it not? Mm-hmm. Please, Shedrick, share with us the move now from rugby.
Yeah.
To MMA, because you're not a professional rugby player now, as good as you were, but you are soon to be
champ. Yes. Definitely soon to be champ. Definitely.
Yeah.
Tell us about that journey.
So after sitting out, I stopped doing everything that I was doing at the time. Like everything. I was like, I don't want to do anything anymore. I just want to sit and just want to go through my head and think. It was the most darkest moment of my life because I can't do nothing. Yeah. I can't use my leg. I can't even walk. I just have to sit there. And my uncle, Steve, he's very, very dear to me, that man. He looked after me as well. Obviously, when we moved to Central, he started looking after me as well. He told me, he's like, look, you've got a good body, good reach. You're quite a nice build. Why don't you try boxing? I'm like, ah, man, I just brush it off my shoulder. I'm like, I'm still thinking about other stuff now at the moment. Sure. And he's like, no, try rugby. Try boxing. That might be another sport you might enjoy. Why don't you give it a try? And then he had a company, a plumbing company. Mm. So he was going to close to King's Court to buy stuff and build a warehouse. And he asked me to just tag along with him at the time. That was after 2 years of my leg because it had gotten a bit better there and stuff.
Sure.
And then he's like, look, just come through, come and help me. Get some stuff so I can pack in the back of the bucky. So I went with him. And before going to build away, and he's like, nah, let's just go to King's Court quickly. I just want to see something. So I walked with him in King's Court, and I'm just walking behind him, and he's walking in Peswa. And I'm like, why is this guy walking in? What is he doing in here? And then I walked behind him, and he asked for Chris. And he met Chris, and then he introduced me to Chris. And Chris was like, nah, I just have to come to training. They gave us the time for the classes.
Wow.
And I came for like a month or so. I stopped. I was like, nah.
Boxing was not your thing.
It's not my thing. This thing. And it's like, this is not my thing. And he kept saying it. And I was like, okay, I'll go. And I started going back again. And frequently started going a lot more than I'd usually do. Mm. And that's why I was spending the whole day.
Suddenly you started being your thing.
Yeah, and then I got caught up in it. And ever since then, never stopped again.
I don't understand it. Like I always say to Rian, why would you let people beat you?
Yeah, so just for context, so I also trained with Chris at Peswa. I've been there for a couple of years. I'm not near Shadrack's level. Like I was actually laughing before we started. I came across pictures of a competition where I was actually competing against Shadrack.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking like, yeah, this looks really nice because the pictures are very flattering for me. Meantime, I got just killed, basically, because I've got a day job. This is what he does for a living, okay? But Shadrack, tell us, Peswa, your PE Submission Fighting Academy, you've been working with Chris Bright.
No.
You were very fortunate in the sense that, and I'm not saying this because Chris is a friend or anything, your intro into MMA was literally one of the best, if not the best gym in the country, one of the best trainers. What has that transition been like? Like you said, what about it was that really gripped you, that said, this is something I can get behind and that I can really spend my life doing?
First of all, like, the way that man believes in me is crazy. Sometimes he believes in me more than I believe in myself. Like, he would look at me dead in the eyes. It's like, you gonna clear that division. And I'm like, are you serious? He's like, I'm dead.
You will clean that division.
He believes so much in me, and he gives me the freedom to be whoever I am. Like, people have always limited me. People have never listened to me. Like, they'll listen, and whatever you have to say. But he's always there to guide me. He's not there to rule over me. He's like, no, I'll guide you. If this is wrong, I'll tell you it's wrong. And if it's not wrong, go ahead and do it. Even if people are negatively saying bad things about it, if he feels it's right, it's like, that's it, do it. So for me, the way he backs me and the skills that he's given me, it's way beyond MMA, way beyond just putting the gloves and fighting. The way I see things now, the way I think about things, is matured me in life. Like, I'm more mature than I've ever been. And he's taught me way more than I've ever thought how I would ever learn in life. Not just inside MMA or inside of what I do, even outside. Like, he focuses around everything. It's not just focusing around what you can do, what you're good at. He wants to focus on your life and how you're carrying yourself outside, because it's not just about who you are. Yeah. And he showed me one thing: no matter how great you are, stay humble.
Yeah.
Besides him as well, the team around, like rugby was great. I had team. I had a family. I'll never forget them. But then I met a bunch of guys that I train with right now. These guys would give their life for me, and I know that they would give everything they have for me, and vice versa. I'll give everything I have for these guys. And it's more like I've always told them, I spend more time than you. I spend with my family. So you guys are my family. Sure. These guys always know that. And from 8 in the morning until 8 p.m., I'm at the gym with them. I'm see my family only on Sunday. And at home, I stay with my girlfriend, and I see her from about 9 p.m. And then I'm going to sleep early, and in the morning I'm awake. She goes to work, so I don't see her as much as I see these guys. But I tell these guys, you guys are family to me. I've got a family, but you guys are family to me. And I had family in rugby. Like, I was seeing them 4 hours a day. That's how you understand.
It's like twice a week.
Yeah. These guys is different. It's a very different story. You don't show up in the gym, they want to know why you're not in the gym. If there's a problem, they want to know.
Yeah.
They don't want to, like, they know you that well. They see me grumpy. They don't even have to be grumpy. I can fake a smile. They know I'm faking a smile. Yeah. They know that's a fake smile.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah, that's amazing to have such people in your life.
Looking at your, we touched now on the team that you're with now, your career in MMA, and I've been following your career. I mean, I've known you for a good couple of years. Yes, I've been following your career since amateur, since pro, everything. You signed with the EFC, Extreme Fighting Championship, the biggest MMA promotion in Africa, and you came onto the scene with a big splash. I mean, you're known for, like, your power, for your striking. I mean, your first opponent within the first minute,
45,
yeah. It was like chaos, because it was a takedown. He took you down. He was on top of you. You jumped up and you knocked him out. Yeah. I mean, it's crazy, and that happened in less than a minute. You know, like 45 seconds or something like that. Seconds, that was spectacular, and you showed that personality that, like you said, you're always positive, and you were, uncharacteristically of the rest of the PESFA crowds, you were quite a loud, loud guy.
Who says that?
Yeah. but that drew a lot of attention to you, and landed you two quick fights again. I mean, some guys were reluctant to fight you, obviously, and then there were two quick fights, and then your fourth fight, there was a lot of things behind that fight. There was weight cuts, there was a different opponent, all that things. But that was the last setback, I could say, that you had. Run us through what happened there, what went through your mind after that fight. Run us through the fight, and then what happened afterwards, yeah.
So, that fight, I think I hated it then, but now I actually love it more. I think I love that fight way more than literally all my fights now, because I thought I learned as much as I did in life, but that fight actually reminded me. It's like, dude, you're still learning a lot, bro. Like, there's a lot to learn here. So I was like, shot. So in that fight, I signed a contract for middleweight, which is 84 kilogram, 185 pounds. And I think on a Monday, in a week fight, our fight week, on a Monday, we had a press conference, I think. So I showed up in a press conference. I was 82 kilograms. I cut way below than I should have even. So I showed up at 82 kilograms. And after the press, it was a Tuesday, yeah, because Wednesday it was weigh-in. Yeah, it was on a Tuesday. So after the press, one of the EFC matchmaker came to me and asked me a question. He's like, is the matchup for the light heavy? And light heavy, that's 94 kilograms. That's like 12 kilos above where I am right now. So I was like, no, it's the middleweight fight. And he's like, are you sure? I'm like, no, you can look at the contract. You sent me the contract. You sent him the contract, so you should have the contract. So he's like, okay, I'll look at it. I looked at the contract, and then he said, that they signed a light heavyweight. So I was like, no, well, they can also look at the contract right now and make sure. So we both look at the contract. It was middleweight for me. It was middleweight for them. So I'm like, oh, you guys get light heavy. And then Graham told him, They must cut weight, obviously, before tomorrow. We're in, so no problem, shorts. Get home, I think it was around 8, 9 o'clock in the evening. They called Cindy, because I was with Cindy down there. They called the Cindy and they told him, now I have to, it's a catch weight now, so I have to fight 88 kilograms. I was 82, 83 at the time.
Now, in MMA terms, that's almost a weight division. That's a lot of weight to give up. And mm-hmm. specifically, you guys that cut weight, that's a draining process. So now you are below your 84.
Yeah.
Now you have to suddenly shoot up. And this guy hasn't cut as much mm-hmm. because he was at a different weight division.
He's at a different weight division. So I had to rush my body to rehydrate. I had to rush my body to get the carbs in. So basically, I've got about 8 hours to just pick up 8 kilograms.
Yeah.
In a way. So I was like, no, man, that's impossible. We tried. I was 85, 86 kilograms the next day. On way in, got to way in, weighed 86 kilograms. I was like, no, that's fine. That's okay. He showed up. He was 96 kilogram. He didn't even make 88 at all.
He didn't even make heavyweight. I mean, he wasn't even in there for the heavyweight division.
He didn't even make the light heavy. So, anywho, I got a bit furious there. I told Cindy Lee, I'm like, because Cindy was communicating with Chris at the time. So I told Cindy Lee, I'm gonna try and stay calm. You handle it, okay? So Cindy was like, okay, yeah, he was handling it, eh? I just stepped away, started hydrating up, and this guy is busy talking. I'm like, dude, why are you talking? You missed weight twice.
You've already lost.
Yeah, you missed weight twice. Yeah. And that started building up with that as well. So on the way in, we had a way in, official way in. He was still talking in my face. Yeah, before the fight, that evening, the next day, it was still playing in my head because I was really frustrated about it. That was the first thing I shouldn't have done. Get to that mode.
A lot of emotions now involved. Yeah.
Rolled up. Walked out, got in a cage. Fight started. Emotionally, I was fine. When the fight started, everything started nice. I got a bit agitated at all. And he kicked me. I tried to chase him, but I relaxed. I jabbed him. Initiated takedown. I knew he was a bit heavy, so scrambled slowly, got myself up, and then got him into the cage. He kneed me on the groin. And that's when I lost it again.
Yeah.
I just lost it.
This guy's just doing all the wrong moves.
Doing everything wrong. The ref put me on the corner. I can't talk to Chris. He put me away from Chris. Away from Cindy Lee. And I'm really trying to just, because I'm really sore here, my stomach is really hurting, it need me really hard on the groin, and then I look across the ring, he's still talking, he's still walking up, and that lit up some more.
Yeah,
I was still sore, I was like, you know what? I'm just going to get up and do this, I'm not really going to lay down here. So I got up, I was like, yeah, ref, let's go. The ref is like, you got 5, I'm like, I don't care, let's go. He's like, okay, and I heard him. I swear I heard that guy. And as I heard him, I don't know why, I just started really pushing into his range, started pushing into his punches. And he came to me later and said, I've never been hurt like that. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I know, I just made a mistake.
Yeah.
And that mistake got me caught. He threw a wild overhand, caught me, and then he threw another hook, he caught me again, and I was out. I woke up. Your brain kind of resets a little bit, 5-10 seconds prior to that. You just chill there, and then came back to me, and Cindy was like, put your shirt on. Put my shirt on, went and take a shower. I said nothing that day. I just went home. I didn't even go to the hotel. I went to my best friend's place because my best friend stays in Joburg. He didn't even say nothing to me. He's like, I'm going to offer you a glass of whiskey. If you want. I was like, please. I had a glass or two. I just put my head on the couch and I passed out. Woke up that weekend. I literally answered no one on my phone. I did not touch my phone, nothing. And then when I landed at PE, Chris called me. He's like, what happened the next day? Did the sun rise? I said, yes. He's like, so what now?
Yeah.
I think, so what now? I took a week to get over that emotions, and then I accepted it. I was like, yeah, well, the sunrise. So what? Let's move on.
So Shadrack, we touched on that on the setback. No. You came back with a great win after that. I mean, I remember watching that fight, losing my mind after you'd knocked that dude out. The you've got a fight coming up. I think it's like 2 weeks' time. It's
2.5 weeks. Yes.
Yes, 2.5 weeks. Just tell me, how's preparation going, and how do you see this fight going? And then I believe this would be a number one contender fight, if I'm not mistaken.
So I'm already the number one contender. That doesn't change. Luc Macro, who's the champion, is just really running away to go fight somebody else. He's ducking, honestly speaking. So this is the fight I just asked to stay busy. Spoke to Chris. Chris was like, oh, wait, let's stay busy as much as you can. Like you said, clean the division. So I was like, I don't want to wait until March. And in March, I don't even know if I'm going to fight Luke, because Luke might want to duck again.
Yeah.
So I was like, I just want to stay busy. Just give me a fight. So they offered this guy. I really thank him for taking the fight. I really appreciate him for taking the fight. Yeah. There's, like I said, there's a few things we're working on for Luke. If we fight Luke, but we want to implement it in this fight. So knowing that we're enforcing stuff into the game plan to put in for Luke. So, yeah.
Shadrack, in an interview that you did with the Herald, I think it was 2 years ago, you said something. You said, I've been fighting my whole life.
Yep.
I've had to work and fight for everything that I have. Your success in MMA, would you credit that to your journey?
Definitely, yes. I'm grateful of the love I had. I never cursed it. I'll never curse it.
Sure.
I'll never regret it ever in my life, because I believe it prepared me for the person that I am today and the person that I'll become in the future. So I had to go through that hardship. It was important for my life. I'm glad I went through it early.
So Shadrack, what are your plans for the future?
My plan for the future is, like I said, there's a feeling I'm chasing, and I've already set up a plan for me. I was like, I've got 9 years into this career, and I want to make it 9 years max. And within that 9 years, I want to collect as many belts as I can in each division I go to. I don't just want to go to the UFC. I really want the UFC, yes.
Okay.
But I want to cycle the globe. I want to fight in every single promotion that there is out there and collect as many belts as I can. Because for me, success is not just in going in one big promotion. Success is literally claiming that I'm the best in the world. And for me to be the best in the world, I have to go around the globe and clear whatever I have to clear around the globe.
That is awesome. Shadrack, thank you so much for sharing your story and sharing your heart with us. Rian?
Thank you, thank you. Let's keep in English, please. We're all English. Come on now.
Baie dankie.
It's a pleasure.
Darcy.
That's all we have for you today. Yes, wanna know more? Tune in again next week.